Rewind, your week in review is sponsored by the Transportation Development Association of Wisconsin, sharing one goal, enhancing the quality of life in Wisconsin through the development and maintenance of a strong transportation network. The Transportation Development Association of Wisconsin, it's how we get there.
Because I don't want to go backwards. I want to keep going forward together. That's exactly where we're going to go. God bless
you. I'm Steve Walders.
And I'm J.R. Ross.
This is Rewind, Wisconsin-I's look at this week in the Capitol. And this week's version of Wish I Was There, because it was a holiday shortened weekend, focuses on two issues, the debate over constitutional carry, the right to carry a concealed weapon, which would reverse the current premise that you can't carry unless you have a state permit, and should Wisconsin join the other 30 states calling for a U.S. constitutional convention to pass a balanced budget. So here's Wish I Was There.
Every gun owner in this room knows that there are four universal rules of firearms. They're very short. You can say it in 15 seconds. Rule one, assume all guns are loaded, always. Rule two, don't point your gun at anything you don't want to destroy. Rule three, keep your finger off the trigger until you want it to fire. And rule four, make sure you know everything that's behind your target. If you follow those rules, there are no accidents.
It's 86% of gun owners, 85% of current concealed carry permit holders in Wisconsin support the requirements associated with the permit, as do 93% of non-gun owners. So it turns out that among Wisconsinites, those requirements are more universally popular than beer or cheese or Aaron Rodgers.
The four words that I have not heard anyone say today is shall not be infringed. And I wish Senator Taylor was here, because my answer to her question directly would be yes. Your right to keep and bear arms shall be unfettered.
There was a discussion about how this is all about liberty, and I think the whole phrase is life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And for me, life takes the precedence in that phrase. And to me, guns are not life-giving. They're an agent of death.
Cities and counties and even states, the state of Wisconsin, we have to have a balanced budget. It's required. The federal government, however, is different. It can create money. We are at risk because of the amount of the debt, and right now we have low interest rates. I am concerned when interest rates go up that we are on an unsustainable path.
I think that this is a way for people who have, I think, misguided views on our economy and the way that our budgeting process should work. It's a way for them to dismantle either our Social Security system or possibly worse.
So, JR, we'll come back to that concealed carry because there was that very interesting public hearing. But now let's walk through what Joint Finance did last week and note that we'll be talking about next week the major decisions they're going to make. Okay, I got to start with this DNR magazine. Mm-hmm. So, top of the front page yesterday's Journal Sentinel, Joint Finance keeps DNR magazine, cuts back its circulation, publishing cycle from mm-hmm. six times to four. Mm-hmm. Why is this such, why is it a big deal?
Talking to members of the committee, they got countless number of contacts about this. People were passionate about it. And I talked to some Republicans in the committee. They basically said the juice wasn't worth the squeeze. It wasn't worth the hassle of getting rid of it. So they pare it back from six to four. They keep the magazine, but they go from two positions to one, and they also take the director of communications, who's a political appointee at DNR, and make that person the editor of the magazine. So they keep it, right, but they're changing it quite a bit, which is raising the Dems' concerns of, well, this is part of an effort to phase it out, right, and eventually do away with it. Governor Walker made the argument of, this isn't needed. It's something the private sector can do. Why are we in this business anymore? The counter to that was there's nobody else who does something like this, exactly like this, and the people who pay for it want it. It's fairly self-sufficient. I mean, you get in this argument of, is it truly self-sufficient or not, but they have a reserve. They have money, stashed away, and they have subscriptions.
It's been published since 1931, mm-hmm. and the Fiscal Bureau did a paper. It would cost $778,000 to get rid of it, as mm-hmm. the governor wanted. Let's listen to some of the exchange on Joint Finance on the DNR magazine and the decision to cut it from six times a year to four. Let's listen to that.
The largest concern that I have had, that I have heard overwhelmingly from constituents on, is the only reason it appeared to have been proposed to be eliminated by the governor was because they were posting, quote, sensitive information or controversial information like groundwater and pine martens and climate change.
So you're supporting them with six issues, but somehow you're not supporting them with four? You know, like there's some magic in those two issues that somehow you're supportive of those things. I mean, I think we heard one of the arguments we heard was something to the effect of this magazine preserves our natural resources. It's the glue that binds. Somehow it binds at six issues, but not at four?
Which you're admitting it's this is the end of the magazine as we know it. It's going to be phased out. That it was her recommendation to the governor, or basically the governor saying to the secretary, please recommend to me getting rid of the magazine. Which again, I'll get into why I think he did it in a minute, but you're basically saying that we're gonna go from six to four to essentially zero. Don't know when it's gonna happen, but it's gonna happen.
We heard Shanklin talk about, make a reference to the high capacity bill. So mm-hmm. Let's just note that the governor signed that into law.
Yes.
And it grandfathers in 13,178 high capacity wells that will not have to be repermitted when they're repaired, sold, it just grandfathers them in. So that's now the law. Let's look at some other things that the Joint Finance did. They're going to raise the camping fees, mm-hmm. Admissions, and electrical hookup fees. Any big surprise there? This is the second major bump up.
Well, they did a couple of interesting things. They're doing a lot of what Walker wants, but not exactly what he wants. So they're doing the nightly and daily passes.
Yes.
Those go up, but the annual pass does
not. Stays at 28.
He wanted to give the DNR Secretary the authority to bump that up as well by 10 bucks. The electrical hookups, they would raise the cap from 30% to 35%, I think it is. So they're, it's kind of fits a pattern with the committee right now where they're doing most what Governor Walker wants, or at least some way, shape, or form what he wants, but not the whole enchilada. For example, the parole commission, he wanted to do away with it and go back, just have a appointee to take care of it. They said, okay, we'll go from eight person down to four.
Down
and
to four.
Cut staff,
it in half. Right.
But keep the commission there. So they're kind of meeting them not quite halfway on some things, but they're putting their imprint on this budget from top to bottom.
And was it you that reported that the number of paroles issued last year, 63? Mm-hmm. I hadn't seen that number before.
I think that's something right. I mean, Governor Walker, he's not issued any pardons.
Pardons. Well, no pardons.
No pardons.
In his 6 years in office.
And also, you got to remember, too, with the parole commission, this only applies to sentences pre-December 31st, 1999. In 2000, we switched to truth in sentencing, which basically said, if you get 4 years, Steve, doing 4 years.
Yeah.
So it's a dwindling group of people who are covered by the parole commission in anyway.
Yeah, and they also voted to give judges 2% raises. Now, that's what they are beginning to budget for all state employees.
Mm-hmm.
However, our Chief Justice said our justices and judges need 16%.
Yes.
So that's 2% ain't 16.
No, and again with this, the committee said, okay, Governor, you want 2% and 2%, we'll do that, but you want to do a whole new system to determine judicial pay going forward? We're not going to do that. We're going to tweak how we do it right now, but we're going to keep it part of the compensation plan. So, again, they keep doing what he wants, but not the entire thing.
Right. And they also said that assistant district attorneys are going to get a pay raise averaging
$1.97
an hour. $1.97
an hour. There's a 17-step pay progression for assistant DAs. This was established a few years back to try and take them from the bottom to the top. It would basically be one bump up the pay grade for everybody unless you're at the top of the pay grade.
Right. Pittsville will be allowed to put up a sign declaring them what? The geographical center of Wisconsin?
They get $7,500 to declare that very same thing. And there's also $75,000 to basically go to a community to help a ski club keep doing this ski jump tournament every winter.
We don't like earmucks, but... But, JR, let's talk about the governor's no property tax increase on the median valued home.
Mm-hmm.
Promise. Now, let's frame that up. He said that the property tax bill in that median valued home in December of 2018 will be lower, even if it's a dollar or two lower, than December of 2014.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there's two factors there that put that in jeopardy. I'll let you talk about the lottery credit. But first, the... one premise of that is that the budget is going to agree with Walker to do away with the property tax levy for forestry.
Yep.
That's worth about $26 on the average home. But now talk to me about the lottery credit, which you reported last week.
So, you know, as part of your property tax bill, you get a credit from lottery sales. It's amazing the things in Wisconsin we've created to try and lower your property taxes.
The first dollar credit, the school levy credit, the lottery credit.
But this is part of how they sold the lottery years ago that would help reduce property taxes. So off of sales, you get a credit every year on your property tax bill. Sales have been soft this past year. There have been no big mega million, you know, big time Powerball jackpots. So sales have gone down. When sales go down, there's a smaller pot of money for the credit. It's right now projected to be $13.2 million less than we thought it was going to be. That equates $6 on the credit in the first year of the budget and a dollar in the second year.
Yeah.
Why is that important? Governor Walker has been saying publicly, I will veto any budget, the entire budget, that raises property taxes. He publicly hasn't said like what his benchmark is, because property taxes have gone up the last 2 years. So 15 and 16, those bills crept up through a number of factors, including things like referendum.
Local school district referendums.
So he's saying those bills that go out in December of 2018, right after the election, by the way,
yes,
will be lower than in 14. So he kind of clarified in a letter to some Republicans this week, my pledge means this, that lower in 18 than 14. Well, his budget, as currently crafted, does not meet that pledge because a lottery credit has gone down. What's that mean? Lawmakers, who, by the way, have had a contentious relationship with Governor Walker in the last few months with his budget process, would have to dig deep and find $13.2 million to make up for that lack of sales to pump into a credit, or you can pull any number of levers in the budget to lower property taxes. For example, and I'm not saying they're going to do this, but we have school funding. Governor Walker wants to put $649 million in the school funding,
which is up for joint finance next week.
You have a per pupil cap on how much you can spend, because it caps how much property taxes and state aid. You could, in theory, again, this is just a theory, to lower it by a buck or two.
Yeah.
Well, a buck or two down is a big deal for property taxes. I don't think they want to do that because K-12 is a very big thing. But that's just an example of we can find areas in the budget to lower property because it is a multiple pot formula. You've got school aids, aid to local governments, these credits that are going out there. So that's a challenge for them. One, can they find the money? Two, do they want to? When I talked to the co-chairs of finance this week, Alberta Darling said, yes, we want to try. Our options are limited, but we want to try. John Nygren said, not so sure. In part because where do we find the money? You know, how do you do this?
Yeah.
Don't forget, there's also this transportation package over here they still have to deal with that's not up yet. And Senate Republicans have talked about finding general purpose revenue to free up money to borrow.
To ship the transportation fund.
Well, guess what you need to lower property taxes to replace
General fund credits to buy down our property taxes.
Where do you find that money?
So that's okay,
one of the difficulties they face.
A big
right
part
now
of this, as we said, is this forestry state property tax levy. Now, after some grumbling, the co-chairs of finance, Senator Darling and Representative Nygren, have said that committee is going to go along with that.
Yes.
So Walker can bank $26 on the median valued home.
And that is $184 or $185 million in general purpose
revenue. $90 a year.
So that is good for property tax bills for Governor Walker and his pledge, but it also means they're taking one pot of money off the table they could go dip into these other priorities.
Right. Okay. JR, I'm really confused about the estimates. How much would be saved by self-insuring for health care? The governor opened the bidding in his February budget speech by saying this would save $60 million between January and the end of 2019. Last week, DOA Secretary Neitzel said, "Oh, the number's up to 103." This week, Fiscal Bureau comes in and said potential savings of 47. All these numbers is one more reason. This is the question that Joint Finance is not going to approve this.
Oh, even without this, they weren't going to approve this. Nygren and Darling have had problems with this for a while because they don't feel there's certainty with what's going on in the healthcare market right now to do this, to assume these savings. Now, the governor's argued over and over again, look, we put out contracts, we've gotten hard numbers back, you can trust these savings. What Nygren and Darling are saying is, well, we're not sure because what's going on with the Affordable Health Care Act? Are they going to do a repeal and replace of Obamacare? Is that going to happen this year? Also, John Nygren, who's in the insurance industry, will tell you that if you take all these state employees out of the general insurance pool, you risk the rates for people like you and I going up because there are fewer people in the pool. So there's all kinds of things that they're worried about. So they were kind of saying, no way. They have formally objected to the contracts this week.
Yes.
So the Walker administration has taken these contracts that they got, submit them to joint finance and say, here they are. You have 14 days to approve them or passive review, say they're okay. If you object, you have to have a whole hearing. Well, they're going to have a whole hearing in June, going to vote them down.
Yeah.
And say, no, we're going to do something else. And now the question is, where do you find that money to make it up? They could, for example, ask state employees to pay more for their co-pays and deductibles. They could look at this reserve that is over there.
Which Fiscal Bureau said this week is $144 million. And that raised the eyebrows of Nygren Darling and other members of the Joint Finance.
And one thing they said was, this has been built up by money from state employees. Why wasn't it turned around then and sent back to them somehow or use a lower rate? So they're talking about maybe grabbing that, a one-time grab, to take care of some of these costs. Now, Secretary Neitzel from the Department of Administration said it's one-time money. It means a one-time fix, which means that's not there going forward.
Yeah.
But sometimes in state government, we make one-time decisions.
Oh, we're very good at that.
They get us through 2 years.
Especially with federal surplus money in the after the Great Recession.
But I think it's clear that finance is not going to do these contracts. I mean, there are some members of the legislature that you've seen on social media saying, we want to save this money. Why are we not doing this? But as long as the co-chairs are saying no and the committee stands with them, that's not going to happen.
Well, but meanwhile, the new element is they want an audit of this reserve. But an audit's going to take a year plus. So that punts the issue down the road. Bottom line, they do not improve. They do not approve self-insurance.
No.
Right. Okay, now let's go back to the emotional hearing over the bill that would say, right now, you cannot conceal carry unless you have a state permit. This would reverse that, saying you have a constitutional right to carry unless you're prohibited, convicted of a crime, stuff like that. So let's listen. Earlier in which I was there, you got some public testimony. Let's listen to some interaction between legislators debating the proposed constitutional right to conceal carry.
I can walk into my local Gander Mountain and buy a handgun, strap it to my hip, and walk up and down the street. What I cannot legally do in the state of Wisconsin is throw a sweater on. That's what we change.
The issue is whether or not we believe that it is better, fundamentally, for individuals to be trained on a weapon so that everybody is more safe, if you're going to say that it can exist. And I just want to fundamentally say that the difference is that you don't believe that they need to be trained.
I read in the stories about how kids sometimes get a hold of a gun in a car, loaded, and they shoot it, and it's a tragedy. Shouldn't there be some sort of a restriction on either carrying unloaded guns or maybe having a safety valve on a gun, safety lock on a gun?
Senator David Craig and Representative Felskowski are very serious about that. Mm-hmm. What I can't figure out is whether that is also on the agenda of the leaders, and especially in light of Governor Walker's comments yesterday when he signed the bill making cheese, let me get this right, the official state dairy mm-hmm. product. He was asked about this, and he said he believes current laws are, quote, appropriate. And then he added, overall, people are pleased with the way the laws are today. Was Walker saying, hey, Legis, don't put this on my desk?
I don't get the impression he wants to deal with this ahead of the election next year. You know, when concealed carry was an issue percolating the Capitol years ago, it was pushed a number of times before it finally got done. And it was always about this training component. Right, before you can get a license to go out and carry a concealed weapon. This is a different situation.
And a background check, yep.
Craig and Felskowski will say, look, you have to pass a background check to get to buy a gun at Gander Mountain or wherever. Of course, what happens at a gun show or private sale, there's that. But to them, this is the next step because you can carry openly. You can go buy a gun and put it on your hip and carry it openly. So what's the difference between that and then putting on, as Felskowski has, a sweater?
Right.
But it is a different stance from what was sold to the Capitol during the course of this debate past years. Governor Walker, I think the impression is very passionate about this issue, really wants to deal with this, had the election, because now we're taking a whole other step on the concealed carry debate beyond what we were told before. So, you know, but remember with Walker, he's got other issues. He said, I don't want to deal with this. But when it became clear it was going to happen no matter what, then he got on board, got ahead of it. For example, right to work. 2014, said it's not something I'm even thinking about, not going to come up, won't come over to my desk. And even after, like, Fitzgerald said after the election, 14, we're going to do this, he was like, focus on my budget, until it became clear this is going to happen. Then now he goes out and brags about it, how we're right to work.
He state. Ran to it. He, yeah. he embraced it. But I was curious, how did you, I read the statement by Attorney General Brad Schimmel on the concealed carry law, the Fiskalski Craig, as saying, I don't oppose it. He called it a potential logical extension of our current law. So is there a gap here between Governor Walker saying current laws are appropriate and Schimmel saying, I kind of almost am willing to go along with this?
Good question, because nobody said no yet. They haven't flat out said, I don't, it's like nobody, Walker's not said, I will veto this if it comes to my desk, right? Mm-hmm. So until you have an ironclad no, I'm not sure where they exactly fall on the spectrum of this bill.
Okay, new subject. We now have two potential opponents for Justice Michael Gableman in the April election
2018.
Milwaukee County Circuit Court Judge Rebecca, how do you pronounce it? Dallet?
Dallet.
Mm-hmm. Dallet announced yesterday that she's going to run against Gableman. It's her intention. And she joins Madison attorney Tim Burns. Now, they have different resumes because Tim Burns is in private practice.
Yes.
And Dallet, a former prosecutor for 11 years.
Yep.
Elected a judge in 2008 and reelected in 2014. But where does Gableman stand? Do we have any reason to believe he's not going to seek reelection?
Well, go back a year ago, and Annette Ziegler, who was up this spring, was raising money, doing fundraisers, and after June 30th of 2016, reported like a couple hundred thousand dollars in the bank. We haven't seen a similar activity from Michael Gableman, so that has prompted some speculation. Is he going to run or not? He hasn't said he's not going to, but he hasn't said that he is. Now, you can argue the court's in session, he's trying to get his decisions done. Once those are knocked out, there's plenty of time. But he's not taking the same steps we saw from Ziegler a year ago. So that's going to, anytime that happens, it's going to prompt speculation. What's interesting about the dynamic now with Dallet and Burns is that we kind of saw something similar in 2016 with Rebecca Bradley. Joanne Klotberg ran as a progressive, and Joe Donald ran kind of door in the middle. What you're seeing is Burns trying to run as the progressive and Dallet trying to strike more of a nonpartisan pose. Well, Joe Donald did not do well in the primary last year. The question becomes, though, this is a little different because both Joe Donald and Joanne Klotberg were judges. Tim Burns is not a judge. And rightly or wrongly, in our kind of electorate right now, people think you have to be a judge to be on the Supreme Court because it is the state's highest court. Now, you're not running a trial. You are dealing more with theoretical issues or application of the law. So you could argue that you don't need to have courtroom experience to do that kind of stuff. But for voters, they've tended to lock into that. Now, the counter has been from some liberals I've talked to is that, look, what we've done before hasn't worked, okay? Joanne Klopfenberg was a progressive. It didn't work. Why not run as an open, just flat out say it, you know, I am a progressive. We're going to run this way and go for broke that way. They haven't worked before. What they've been doing hasn't worked so far, so why not try this? That's the argument I've heard.
But they're seeking an office that is officially nonpartisan. So here's my question. Dallet and Burns are speaking to the Democratic State Convention. Mm-hmm. Can you remember a candidate for the Supreme Court speaking to either a Democratic or a Republican convention?
No.
I've gone to decades of them.
I've known a number of them who have spoken to fundraisers, spoken to the county parties. I've known them to do that. So, and let's be honest, these are nonpartisan in name only. If Gableman runs for election, he is running as a conservative/Republican. He will have the state GOP behind him. The state GOP has spent money on the last several Supreme Court races. Now, the Democratic Party has not been as quick to embrace these races as something you're involved in, but interviewing Martha Lanning, for example, ahead of this weekend's convention, if reelected, she committed to spending money on behalf of somebody challenging Gableman next year. So that party's going to get involved. These are becoming partisan races. That they just really are.
Okay. I'm just surprised that both Dallet and Burns are speaking at the Democratic State Convention.
Dallet's campaign told me that she'd speak to Republicans if they were having their convention later on, that she's going to talk to anybody, kind of be more of a nonpartisan, like down the middle kind of candidate.
Okay. Which leads us to previewing the Democratic State Convention, which opens today, continues through tomorrow at the Marriott in Middleton. That's where you and I are going to be in a few hours. Let's talk about the major themes of that convention. How much of an anti-Trump theme, number one, How much of a let's get fired up to reelect Tammy Baldwin? Mm-hmm. These are the themes that I see emerging. Let's vet X number of candidates, potential candidates for governor against Walker. And then, oh yeah, Saturday, we're going to have to reelect the new state chair. So that's, am I right in seeing those four themes?
Oh yeah. Plus there's also the energy question. I mean, it kind of plays into the Donald Trump and the anti-Trump thing, but we've heard all these stories about how energized the base is. Will we see that this weekend with the Democrats? Republicans, so they had about 800 people up in the Dells. Now it's the Dells. You know, it's not Madison. It's a little bit different situation. But they also, the Democrats, have a contested election for chair. But if you have a bigger turnout, does that mean anything? Maybe, maybe not. The fight for the chair's race, is it going to be really about the soul of the party or where it goes? You know, a little bit. Big question is going to be with Martha Lanning. She got elected in 2015. In 2016, the Democrats really took it in the shorts. I mean, they're not used to losing Wisconsin presidential election. They're not used to seeing losing a Senate race in a presidential year. So will Martha Lanning be blamed for those things? And people say, well, we lost last year, end of story. Oh, by the way, you didn't find a candidate for Annette Ziegler in 2017. So we're going to blame you for these things. We think this means change in power. Or will delegates say, look, they've only been in office for a year. Since then, you now have hired these five regional directors, a state person oversee them, so you're putting your plan in place. We're giving you another chance to go forward. What I've heard from Democrats is that they're more concerned with whoever wins on Saturday. Can that person have a competent staff? Can that person raise money from outside groups? And I'm not talking like just anybody, but like the DCCC, these national Democratic organizations, they have them invest in Wisconsin to fund the turnout operation and raise money for the party itself. If that person can do that, doesn't matter who it is. Now, Republicans want to talk about this party's in disarray. They don't have a candidate for governor. They're a mess. So for them, they're going to try and capitalize whatever happens on Saturday.
Yeah.
If Lanning wins re-election, oh, but she was challenged. You know, this is a problem. And if Kennedy wins, for example, Brian Kennedy, oh, this is the party's fractured. They have a big problem. So the Republicans are trying to try and play up the divisions in the Democratic Party.
Okay, right, but let's one more element of this that I want to dwell on. This is the first convention where Second District Congressman Mark Pocan has a broader portfolio now as head of the progressives. So mm-hmm. does that put him on par with Senator Baldwin in terms of charting future goals and campaign themes for Democrats nationally?
No, she's statewide. So well, Mark's no, still got
understand.
His corner.
I understand, but he's got this new leadership role.
Yes, he's definitely going to have a presence, but let's face it, 2018 is about Tammy and the governor's office, all right? So they're not focused on Mark Pocan's race. Mark Pocan's profile has been elevated significantly with this, but Tammy Baldwin is still statewide elected, the last statewide elected other than Doug La Follette, who, let's be honest, has been there for 40 years, minus 4 years in the 70s and 80s, I think it was. But Tammy's it. Like, if they lose that race, it's talking like dark days for Democrats next fall.
But don't they have to balance the anti-Trump versus, hey, we really have to take care of business back at home,
yeah.
back home? With
you have to have a message. You can't just win on hatred. You know, you have to have a message. So what's that message going to be? They're talking about an economy that works for everyone. That's the message from Baldwin. You know, an economy that works for everyone. So I expect to hear that from her tomorrow. And then
okay.
Wisconsin Dairyland Populism she's talking about.
That's right. Wisconsin and I is going to carry that the convention live. I'll be doing interviews there. You guys will be doing one of your polls.
Straw poll. I'm going to be vlogging all day long.
Okay. Finally, we only have a few seconds. JR, question on this. The new Fiscal Bureau memo says the transportation fund is going to have $93.4 million more than projected earlier. Does this relieve some of the push by Assembly Republicans for a long-term solution that could include raising the gas tax and
possibly feeds? Some of the money that LFB noted was in the, I mean, the governor a month ago said, hey, we got us more money.
Oh.
There's a little overlap there. The bigger thing is, if you ask Robin Voss, Assembly Speaker, does that $93 million pay for 94 North South? He'll say no.
No.
So it takes some pressure off. It helps create some opportunities. But to do 94 North South is not $93 million.
Okay. So the fundamental impasse remains over transportation funding.
Just a little less pressure, but yes, it's still there.
A little less pressure because that $93 million balance, the $93 additional dollars is only 2.6% of transportation funding of $3.4 billion over the biennium. Okay, finally, let's just preview Joint Finance next week. Building program, corrections, choice, K-12, and the lottery credit.
Mm-hmm.
Busy week.
Yeah.
I'm Steve Walders.
And I'm J.R. Ross.
That's Rewind for June 2nd.
Rewind, your week in review is sponsored by the Transportation Development Association of Wisconsin, sharing one goal, enhancing the quality of life in Wisconsin through the development and maintenance of a strong transportation network. The Transportation Development Association of Wisconsin, it's how we get there.